Hello and welcome to the Industry Leaders Podcast, where we talk to the leaders of some of the most exciting retail and direct brands and learn the real stories behind their success, their challenges, and their plans for the future. I'm Sarah Ho-Boyle, and this podcast is brought to you by More2, the marketing science people. I'm delighted to be joined on show today by Adam Byrne, founder and creative of menswear brand Marlborough Byrne. Now, Adam founded the business back in 2007 on the premise that menswear needn't ever compromise on style. We are absolutely not talking about budgie smugglers here. The brand's ethos is very considered, its appeal is international, and it's been worn by everybody from 007 to Michael Fassbender, and even Graham Norton is following on Instagram. Adam, it is great to have you here. How are you doing?
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm absolutely delighted to have you here. So before we get into kind of the nuts and bolts of the brand and the business, I'd love to hear a little bit about your kind of earlier career, because your route into fashion, I think, wasn't, you know, what you'd call the typical one. So what did you do before creating Marlborough Byrne?
Well, I did all sorts of things. So it wasn't that I set out to become a fashion designer. And I'm not a fashion designer, but I wasn't one of those people who had this sort of huge dream that I wanted to work in clothing or in fashion. It was much more that I tried certain things and I hadn't really found the thing that I was interested in or the thing that I was particularly good at. And so before that, you know, I'd worked from all sorts of things. So left college and worked in an advertising agency. I was an estate agent. My first real thing was I worked in the voluntary sector. So I worked as a major donor fundraiser for a range of different charities. So whether it was HIV or prisons or children's charities, I did that for 7 or 8 years and that was great. But I got offered a job that I didn't particularly want. And there was no reason not to want the job. So I went back to college and studied photography and worked as a portrait photographer for a few years. And that was sort of going nowhere. And so I reached 40 and I was looking for something to do. Friends sort of had their own careers and found their own way. But I just hadn't really found the thing I wanted to do. And then I had this particular idea. And so the idea resulted in where I've ended up today.
And can you tell me, like, what was that idea? What did you want to do when you...
There was a moment, I was told the story a few times. I was staying in a hotel in Rajasthan and there was a particular moment where I had to go and change for lunch. So I went to the restaurant, I was wearing a swim shorts and, yeah, okay. So I went back to my room, changed, and afterwards just saying, oh, I don't... How annoying was that sort of thing? Oh, I don't want a swim short. I want a short that I can swim in. So I want a tailored approach to swim shorts. And really it just stemmed from there. That moment of sort of lying on a sun lounger after lunch, playing with words and thinking, oh, maybe there's an idea there. And that's really where it started. And then came back to London, did some market research, which was fundamentally just looking around shops. There's no huge great plan in the background. And put together this one product, which was a tailored swim short. I really just took to that play on words and looking at how a pair of trousers was made, did a sort of pattern cutting course, which I didn't last at, but looking at the way tailored trousers are made, the way they're worn, how do we want them, the aesthetic and the appeal of them, and developed a pair of swim shorts.
So you are, I think, a classic example of a brand that's built itself around a simple product that's done very, very well. Can you tell me a little bit about how you created that hero product? And secondly, how you kind of slowly added more categories and more products onto the brand without losing the essence of the brand?
Well, the swim shorts were where we started. That's the thing that I had the idea for in India and we developed. And I think without doubt, it's been a key reason why we've got to where we are now. That fact that I could only afford to make one product, the fact I did one pair of shorts in four lengths. And it's the fact that all I could talk about for 3 years was a pair of shorts. I had nothing else to talk about. So the thing about being the tailored approach, the things about double stitching, 5-year guarantees, quality, trust, customer service. You know, I had nothing else to do apart from talk. We've got new colors or new prints coming in the shorts. And that focuses everyone in, focuses the customer, focuses press, focuses all your communication. And in retrospect, having that one thing, it was your hero product and you became known for that. And I think as I go back to that other point, you know, having a range, nobody needs another rail of clothes, but having a specific product that is you are known for, you know, whether look at Burberry in the trench coat, and Hermes in the Birkin and the car shoe and Chanel number 5, you know, all those brands that have those key products in them, which is their hero product, without that transcends the test of time and you can reinvent it every season, has been absolutely key. And also what that product does is then becomes the essence and the center of the brand. So if your polo shirts don't feel like the pair of shorts, you shouldn't do them. if your outerwear doesn't have the same DNA and values as that pair of shorts, you shouldn't be doing it. So it helps you with decision making later on. But again, you know, it wasn't strategic. It was, I could only make one product. I had one fabric base. I had one side fastener. I had one zip. It simplified the whole business, but it enabled us to just focus the customer and focus everyone on that. And it's still, you know, I think it's a fantastic thing that 15 years down the line, it's still 35% of our sales.
Yeah.
And I think there's way more opportunity for it still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. I mean, if you ever decide to do women's shorts, I would be absolutely up for that.
Well, that's another story.
Another story, I'm sure. And how involved are you now in design of every piece that you see on the website or you see in the shop?
I'm part of everything. We obviously have a design team now who are far more experienced in how you design a garment and how you construct it and how you source it and how you put it together. But I'm definitely, you know, anything the customer sees, touches, wears, hears, feels, reads, I'm probably overly involved. I'm one of those types of people. That's the bit I love. So we have a strong design team. We have people who look after print and they do a fantastic job. But I think to my anything right at the very beginning of the season, I will develop a brief or come up with a story or come up ideas, and then I work that up with the head of marketing, our chief marketing officer, and with the head of design, and we put that together, and then the collection starts coming together from there.
And who is your customer, or who are your customers?
People expect you to give a certain age group or a profession or a set of interests. And it isn't really that. With all of our brands, it's about a particular sort of aspiration or a particular approach to life. I think you enjoy travel. You enjoy meeting people. You want to get out and about. You know, it's not all of our brands, not a sort of solitary brand in particular. You're about holidays. We're about going away with family and friends, seeing wonderful locations, being in new countries, enjoying different cultures and food and dancing to different music. So I think the customer has to embrace that type of life. So whether they're 22 or they're 62, I sort of don't care, you know, but they have to want to travel. They want to be with people. They have a certain enjoyment and an aspiration to how they want to live their life rather than age group. But we do have, you know, clearly internally, we have these two customers, a younger customer profile and an older customer. And we laughingly sort of call them Miles and Giles, and we refer to them constantly in everything we do. But I think much more it's about the way you want to live your life, people who want to do that rather than being this age, they live in these places, they do these types of things. That isn't how we approach it.
And you mentioned briefly, you know, telling the story and storytelling, because that's such a big part to the brand. How does storytelling work itself into your collections? Like you say, your off-roader collection. Can you tell me how that works?
Well, I write from the very beginning. I like a story. As a kid, I liked stories. My grandmother used to tell me stories when I was a child. You know, I'm not a designer. I didn't try and set out as that. My big doubt, my thing I was always worried about with OB was the last thing anybody needs is another rail of clothes. If we just think we're selling product, then you have a far drier or cold relationship with the customer. If you, you know, you tell your friends stories, you know, when you're out and about, when you're at dinner, when you're in the pub, when you're doing whatever, you know, relationships are built by telling stories. And I think if you can bring a product alive through a particular narrative, then it makes it far more engaging for the customer than just trying to sell them, oh, here's another polo shirt and it's made like this and the fabric's this. If you bring them some sort of idea about how it can be worn, what you're doing, the type of emotion you're having while you're wearing it. For me, the big joy of all of our brand is the customer associates us with holidays. The greatest thing is when the customers say, the moment the holiday starts is when my drawstring bag goes into my suitcase. And the fact that people post pictures and they're associating all of our brand with those particular moments in their life is a big joy. And the fact that we can bring that sort of narrative or storytelling to a product just makes it much more exciting for everyone concerned.
Yeah, of course. And speaking of stories, what was your personal big kind of pinch me moment with the brand?
There've been many. They happen every few months and every year. But I think the first one had to be, you know, getting into Selfridges and seeing the effects of, you know, okay, so for 18 months or so, I just worked from a small room and I was selling as I could on the website. But getting into Selfridges and sort of seeing the people's reaction to the product when you had large amounts of footfall. And I used to go in every Saturday and probably most of Sundays, and I'd sit and I'd watch customers and you'd talk to them. And it was the first chance you had of sort of seeing a customer try on a pair of shorts, talk to them what was wrong. And yeah, okay, I wasn't supposed to be on the shop floor, but I was, and I'd go and try and help sell. And building relationship, I built a relationship with the people who are selling the team on the floor. That was definitely the first time that, oh, okay, this might work, you know, because you guys are different ages, different sizes, different characters and personalities. And you think, okay, now that was a moment. And the other one was definitely, you know, the bond moment was a big one for us in our fifth anniversary, just seeing that effect of when a global franchise and that having international reach and seeing different countries, which we had people in different customers in different countries who hadn't really known about the brand before, and seeing the opportunity and the possibilities that gave. There are loads of them, but those are two key early ones, I think.
Mm-hmm. So the James Bond connection was Skyfall, for anyone who is doesn't know. Can you tell me, like, how did that 007 connection come about? Did they reach out to you? Did you reach out to them? How did it happen?
I have no, it was pure chance. It really was one of those moments. Yeah, clearly pictures of Sean Connery or pictures of James Bond appear on, I would imagine, pretty much anywhere menswear, any menswear mood board at some point. In the early days of OB, you know, the toweling references, all those sort of the toweling onesie and things like that, sky blue color, all of those have been on the mood boards from the very beginning. So it seemed very natural, but it was one of those moments where my understanding is, you know, Daniel Craig at some point was a customer, and I don't know whether that came back, but it was pure chance, whether it was a stylist or whether it was him, I've no idea. But we got a call and we sent in some shorts and were lucky enough that our shorts were chosen.
Brilliant. Yeah, fantastic. And you've since done a number of 007 collections.
So this is an ongoing relationship that we have, and it's gone on for a few, and it just feels instinctively right. We all do collaborations, and some of them are good and some of them not so good. But I think the most successful ones are either the ones which they have to feel so fundamentally natural, they don't feel forced, or they probably do feel very forced. The very successful ones are ones where you take either both the collaborators or both the partner into different places and you see the brands in completely different ways. But with Bond and OB, it just felt right. It's not just because we had pictures on mood boards, but the DNA, the values, the thing of what Bond is about, you know, humor, romance, travel, adventure, going to exciting places, embracing life. I also like that thing about that Bond ultimately protects you, you know, something about they have a 5-year guarantee and trust and all those. So the alignment of the brand, the DNA of the brands felt right. And, you know, I think that thing of, you know, he's British, but he's fundamentally international. You know, that also was a big thing for OB, you know, being proud of our Britishness, but ultimately our ambition is far more global than that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And speaking of relationships, you know, that feel right and fit right, can you tell me how your relationship with Chanel developed? What happened there?
I'm going to sound like everything's fluke. That was a moment as well. I was at a trade show in Paris and I happened to meet the CEO of Eres, who was a man who was interested in what we were doing. We got on, and there are definitely parallels between all of our brand and Eres. Eres is a women's swimwear brand and there's a similar price point and a similar ethos and a similar take on life. And we were tiny, absolutely tiny at that point. And he suggested I met up with Bruno Pavlovsky at Chanel and we had a coffee and it was a very nice meeting, nothing much. And over the years, it was one of those things that periodically would drop an email and say, we're doing this or doing that, or just keep in touch. And a relationship built over a couple of year, 5 years. And then just when we were planning to do something with the brand, I reached out and anyway, we managed to pull it together. So there wasn't that intention at the beginning. It was just something that happened. It was, again, sounds like one of those lucky meetings. It just was. I met somebody at a trade show who a sequence of events happened after that.
Mm-hmm. And how has the Chanel acquisition changed your relationship with the brand?
With my relationship with the brand? Yeah. Well, nothing hasn't changed my relationship. I'm still madly passionate about all of our brand.
But has it changed how the business operates or how you operate within the business?
Yeah, so it's definitely businesses go through levels of professionalization and growing up. I'm a founder who cares about the DNA and the values, and that, you know, I believe longevity is built by being true to yourself and not just trying to flog people product, but have some sort of values and purpose and, you know, have a character like a person. And with Chanel, they clearly want to do things well. Chanel is one of the greatest brands in the world. They have real values and customer trust and all those sort of things. And all of our brand was also one of those things at an age where you could have taken it in many directions. You could do $8 t-shirts and it'd still be a beach, and $8 swim shorts and it'd still be a beach and resort brand. I believe that Chanel would want to take all of our brand in the direction that I wanted it to be. That gives me confidence. But I think the ultimate thing is about professionalizing, and whether it's expertise in other territories, whether it's legal advice, whether it's support, whether it's, you know, collaboratively working with other brands in the portfolio, it's in particular Eres, you know, it's things like that. But they've been remarkably supportive and everything we sort of wanted from a partner.
Okay, so if you were to give advice then to somebody who was in your position, who's, you know, kind of a small brand, who's doing really well, looking for investment, what would you say to them? How should they position themselves?
Investment goes back to that point of letting people in and finding the right people for you. Identifying, you know, what you want your business to be in 10, 15, 20 years' time, and as well as what you want to get out of it personally, a key to the type of investors that you approach. So with us, you know, I had angel investors, and that was me targeting a particular person who I thought was the right person for us. Saying no to people who you don't think are right. Raising money is fundamentally not that difficult. If you've got a good product or a good service, or you're an investable person, it's easy to get money. I said no twice, and one definitely was totally the right thing to do. Mm. The other one, possibly. Don't go for the easy money. Think about the things your business needs to get done over the next 4, 5, 6 years. Find the right person who's going to support with that. Mm-hmm. And then also, what would their ambitions be for the business? Because, you know, if their ambition is huge scale very quickly, then you'll do that in a different way to if it's going to be nurtured and go at a certain pace. Investors and founders get across each other when they aren't aligned on what their goals are for the next 3, 5, 7 years.
Mm-hmm. And just going back briefly to those times that you said no, what were the reasons you said no? Was it just a gut instinct that you had? Was it?
Yeah, there's one when particular clauses were being put in. When you have these meetings, it's always you're dating, essentially. Everything's good when things are going well. And when you're a small business, you're going to have a lot of off days and things don't go right. And how do people react at those moments? And what could the implications be for you or the team or for the business? And I think I just had particular doubts, and I just thought they're going to be great while things go right, but probably not so great when things. And for me, that was just going to be more hassle in the long term and have wider implications. So I'd rather just walk away from it now and find another partner who'd be a bit more nurturing and supportive, or work with us while things. I just had a gut feeling about it.
Right. So listen to your instincts, what you're saying.
Yeah. But to do that, you have to be very clear going into those meetings what you want out, you know, for the business and personally. There's another thing where I find founders are going down a journey which probably might not be the journey that they wanted to be taken on, because the investors have particular ambitions for a business that they don't marry up.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a common story, I think. And do you ever find it difficult to hand over parts of the business as it grows?
Oh no, I've never had any problem with that. It was my happiest day when we got a CEO.
Really? Yeah. I think that's really unusual.
I do some sort of mentoring with small businesses. And I think one of the key learnings for me was about acknowledging what you're good at and what you can do. And one of the reasons I think OB has worked is because of allowing other people in, allowing other people close, and allowing other people to make decisions about things I fundamentally don't believe I understood. You know, I don't believe I'm ever going to make the best decisions about warehousing or logistics or operations. It's just not what I do. I was happy to get people in and relinquish control of things that I didn't want to do. And I think that was something we did well. We got the right people in.
And another thing that I'm interested to hear about, because, you know, if you start in 2007, you're kind of at the start of kind of e-commerce as we kind of know it now. But you're one of those brands who's managed to switch from an online-only model to having, you know, the wholesale and the store's presence as well. How did you do that? Did you get somebody in? Did you run it? How did it happen?
Yeah, well, in the early days, it was just me for about 3 years, one other person helping. But I say you sort of did everything. And I think when we launched, there were two of us. It was Julia Simpson Olibar, hence where the name came from. But then it became, I took it on, and very amicably. So we started with a website. It cost about £4,000 or £5,000 to build. It was a website out of, you know, there's no budget, and it was an easy way to do it. And it was a learning curve right from the very beginning. As you say, you know, e-com was in its infancy then. It was nowhere near as understood as well, but it was done. And that's where we launched. And I think, you know, I was plugging away at wholesale. I wanted us to be a wholesale brand. You know, I like shops. I like bricks and mortar. I like going out on a Saturday and looking around the shops. And I think all of our brand always felt like it was going to be a wholesale brand. But that took a couple of years. Shop at Bluebird was our very first stockist, and places like Colette, you know, those rather sort of fashion, the directional stores. But then Selfridges was the first big department store. That took 2 or 3 years. And we, if I'm honest, you know, we didn't have the margin at the beginning, and we should have waited a while. The website was where we started. We knew that wholesale, and, you know, clearly with retail, again, you know, I suppose it just felt right. It was about 6 years before we got our first store. Again, these things, just dipping your toe in and doing it slowly. We weren't the type of brand that just did this massive launch into wholesale. We grew quite organically. So as you make mistakes, the mistakes aren't as big. And that was our approach, rather than doing this huge ta-da moment. And yeah, the website was great. You know, in the early days, you know, I'd go to the back of the website every day and see which orders hadn't gone through and email the customers and start building relationships in that way. That's sort of rather hustle type mentality. And doing all the customer service yourself meant that you could speak to people and hear when things went wrong and when things didn't go wrong. In the early days, there just wasn't a strategy. The website was what we could afford. We were learning on the job. We did an okay job. It obviously, we used it more as a customer relationship tool. The website was very clunky. Wholesale came quite naturally, quite quickly, and retail followed on. There was always the ambition to be a multi-channel business.
And one thing that I find interesting is obviously a lot of your stores are in places like Mykonos or Ibiza, you know, those real kind of holiday destinations. How do you deal with the seasonality of those locations?
Well, there are two parts to that. One is how we manage the seasonality of the business. And the second part is the seasonality of those particular stores. And the seasonality of those particular stores, you just have to budget those in, because clearly Mykonos is not as busy in December and November and January. But they are those key resort areas, the places where our customers go to enjoy our product, where they go on holiday, are absolutely key for where we meet them. And then we can try and build relationships with them from that point. So if somebody's on holiday in San Jose or Ibiza or Miami or wherever it is, it's worth its weight in gold to meet them at that point. You acknowledge that they're going to be quieter at certain points in the year, and you build those figures into your cash flows and all your budgeting. As to the business part of it, you know, I think right from the very beginning, that's been the question: what do you do in winter? What do you do? But it's always sunny somewhere. You know, some people have traveled the whole time. You follow the sun, you just take your marketing and you try and, you know, very early on, we got into Australia very early on. And I think that was because, you know, English, we couldn't translate the website. So Australia and America were our obvious places to start. And we started getting orders from Australia very quickly. And clearly their summer is totally the opposite of us. So you just start trying to talk gear stuff to Australia and to America. But there are all sorts of other challenges. I've never held with that all of our brand is a seasonal brand, because we're categorically not. And people travel so much, whether that's right or wrong, but all of our brand is about holidays. We're about going away, and people, you know, whether it's for 2 days or whether it's for 2 weeks, you know, people are traveling all year round.
And just touching there on sustainability, as you did, I mean, obviously, you know, it's not even a buzzword anymore. Yeah. But can you talk to me how you're working sustainability into the brand?
Yeah, so years ago, you know, one of my key challenges or key issues with all of our brand was that, you know, to wear our product, you have to get on an aeroplane, or you're going into the oceans, or you're on a boat, or whatever it is. But I still fundamentally believe, you know, I love the fact we can enjoy other parts of the world. I love meeting other people. I love going to different towns. I love eating all the food. You know, just, I believe we shouldn't be, I think just embracing a wider world is a good thing. And I think anyone who's ignoring climate change and sustainability and not doing it is just wrong. So very, you know, all those issues in the early, you know, 3 years in, sort of 15 years ago. So all those issues, you know, 12, 13 years ago, were bubbling away. One of my regrets is that we didn't build that in right from the very beginning. So I think if you build, you know, especially in the early days, to build a business based on sustainability, you do it a certain way. You make decisions which allow you to do that. And because we didn't make those choices right at the very beginning, and it niggled away and niggled away and niggled, and then we did it later on, that presented its own challenges. So we've embraced it. It's been a long road. It's been something we've talked about for 12 years. It's over the last sort of 6-7 years, we've been actively we have targets in place. We measure our carbon footprint. Every product, we can measure the carbon footprint of a particular, whether it's a swim short or a t-shirt or a piece of knitwear, and that's readily available to the customer so they can see whether they're eating a fruit salad or an ice cream sundae. We have targets about offsetting. Now, clearly, you know, then we're trying to reduce the amount that we have to offset every year, but we're very aware of it. It's something the team, everyone feels incredibly passionately about. And it's something we're doing everything we can to do. And obviously looking at things like B Corp and stuff like that for the future.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, looking to the future, what are you looking forward to in the next 12 months or so?
What's coming in the next 12 months? What, yeah. For all of our brand or for me? Yeah.
Well, I don't.
I think we've barely started. You know, I look at all of our brand and I just think we've barely started. And people sort of talk about, you know, because the business was sold and stuff, that's the sort of end of it. But it isn't. It's just the sort of beginning. You know, we've barely reached anyone who could buy a pair of all of our brand swim shorts. There are so many countries in the world that we haven't even begun to start selling it, you know, whether it's South America or Far East, or we haven't made any inroads. So the opportunity there, the opportunity on other categories, you know, we don't do accessories, footwear. If you have the words holiday, you know, why doesn't all of our brand do luggage or skincare or sun care and things like that, you know? So just on an all of our brand level, but also I think this, going back to your storytelling piece, the way you bring a brand alive, the way you bring a narrative alive, the way you start telling stories around this group of clothes or this product which makes it into a brand, then I think that's, we're having lots of very exciting conversations there at OB.
Okay, so watch the space is what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, brilliant. Listen, Adam, that was super. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Adam Brown, founder and creative director of Oliver Brown. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of the Industry Leaders Podcast. And don't forget that you can catch up on all of our previous episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your usual podcast provider. That's it for this week, though. So from me, Sarah Hoboyle, and all of us out here at More Tooth, take care and bye-bye.